Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is René Provost, and I'm a law professor here at McGill University, and it's my pleasure to be chairing this session on the effect of the global recession on global food security. We have this afternoon five panelists that each in his own right has a deep engagement with this issue, but also a perspective that is quite distinct from the next person on the panel, the idea being to bring a diversity of perspective on the significance of the global recession on the issue of food security. So we have five panelists who will speak in turn, and then we will open the floor to interventions, discussions, questions from the audience, to which the panelists will be asked to respond. So in order, the panelists will be Michel Barnier, the Honorable Michael Chong, Hafez Ghanem, His Excellency Professor Heger, and David Melon. Je signale tout de suite que M. Barnier va faire sa présentation en français, et comme c'est l'habitude ici, il n'y a pas de traduction, donc tout le monde est invité à mettre ses oreilles francophones pour cette partie de la présentation. Monsieur Barnier a indiqué que ça lui fait plaisir si vous posez des questions en français ou en anglais auxquelles il pourra répondre par la suite. Donc le premier intervenant, Monsieur Barnier, est membre du Parlement européen et ministre de l'Agriculture et des Pêcheries du gouvernement français. Il a été le plus jeune membre élu à l'Assemblée nationale pour sa région de Savoie, et il a exercé diverses fonctions importantes au sein du gouvernement français, dont ministre de l'Environnement, ministre des Affaires étrangères, ministre des Affaires européennes, a travaillé à la Commission européenne en tant que commissaire aux politiques régionales et à la réforme des institutions européenne. Il a aussi, comme il me l'a mentionné il y a un instant, été co-président du comité d'organisation des Jeux olympiques d'hiver de 1992 à Albertville, en France. Donc, une pluralité d'expériences qui, j'en suis sûr, va inspirer son approche à la question de la sécurité alimentaire. Donc, M. Barnier, s'il vous plaît.
Bonjour à chacune et chacun d'entre vous. You know, when you are the youngest members of the French parliament, the title you lose very quickly. En effet, je voudrais m'exprimer dans ma langue maternelle, une langue partagée par beaucoup de citoyens du monde, en particulier ici, et chacun le comprendra. Je suis très heureux de cette occasion de retrouver Montréal et McGill University, et je remercie beaucoup les responsables de McGill, en particulier vous-même, monsieur le professeur Madame Moutou, de cette initiative et de cette invitation. Comme on vient de vous le dire, j'ai eu l'honneur d'être ministre de l'Agriculture de la France pendant 2 ans, jusqu'au milieu de cet été, pour ensuite m'engager dans une nouvelle étape européenne en réalisant la liste de mon parti aux élections européennes du mois de juin. Et comme vous le savez, pendant les 2 ans, nous avons, la France, eu l'honneur de présider l'Union européenne pendant 6 mois, en 2008. Et j'avais un peu surpris tous les autres pays européens en organisant, au tout début de la présidence française, au mois de juillet 2008, une conférence, dont j'ai tiré d'ailleurs un petit livre, sur le thème « Qui va nourrir le monde ?». Et ça a beaucoup surpris les autres pays européens que la France, le principal pays producteur attaché à la politique agricole commune, pose cette question et cherche des réponses. Donc je voudrais, dans le droit fil de cette conférence de Bruxelles, vous dire les leçons ou les conclusions que nous avons proposées au nom de l'Union européenne. Et puis je vous dirai quelques convictions. Donc, première leçon, c'est que nous devons placer la question agricole et la question alimentaire à nouveau en haut de l'agenda international. Nous sommes dans une crise économique et financière d'une violence inouïe. sans doute la plus grave depuis 1929. Cette crise est une crise de la demande, c'est une crise de l'abondance, c'est une crise d'un système économique et financier riche, c'est la crise d'un monde prospère et développé. C'est une crise de l'excès. Et elle a probablement masqué ou caché pendant quelques temps une autre crise qui a commencé bien avant, qui est celle du monde pauvre, une crise qui est passée de l'excès et du manque et qui n'implique pas de savants et complexes produits financiers, mais des produits beaucoup plus simples et beaucoup plus vitaux qui sont les produits alimentaires, puisqu'aujourd'hui, je l'entendais ce matin au début de la conférence de McGill University, plus d'un milliard d'êtres humains sont en train de mourir de faim. Et cette situation n'est pas le fruit du hasard, mesdames et messieurs. Elle est, de mon point de vue, le résultat de 30 ans au moins de désintérêt à l'égard de la question agricole dans le monde, et notamment des grandes institutions et des grands bailleurs de fonds. 30 ans de réduction des investissements de l'aide internationale dans l'agriculture, 30 ans de démantèlement des politiques agricoles au nom du libéralisme, d'une certaine forme de libéralisme, ce qui a conduit beaucoup de pays en voie de développement très pauvres à abandonner leurs agriculteurs et à dépendre pour leur propre alimentation des importations. Je suis comme beaucoup de Canadiens, de Québécois, très engagés dans un pays proche de vous, proche de la France aussi, historiquement, qui est Haïti, où j'ai lancé comme ministre de l'Agriculture une coopération pour aider les jeunes à s'installer. Ce qui m'a frappé à Haïti, par exemple, c'est que, en raison de cette ouverture générale des marchés et des frontières, tous les œufs d'Haïti sont importés de la République dominicaine. Il y a ici des responsables haïtiens qui pourront le dire mieux que moi. Voilà une des conséquences dans un pays proche, et on pourrait trouver d'autres exemples en Afrique notamment. Tant que nous n'aurons pas résolu cette crise-là, nous n'aurons pas mis fin à ce scandale permanent qui est celui de la faim dans le monde et de cette injustice-là. J'ai dit un jour à la tribune des Nations Unies, comme ministre français des Affaires étrangères, un monde plus juste, un monde plus sûr, c'était la grande ambition des États-Unis, un monde plus sûr sera d'abord un monde plus juste. Un monde plus sûr sera d'abord un monde plus juste, et nous sommes clairement au cœur de ce défi de la justice la plus élémentaire, qui est celle de se nourrir. Je voudrais dire quatre convictions, mesdames et messieurs. D'abord, la nécessité d'investir à nouveau, secteur privé, secteur public, dans l'agriculture, de remonter l'effort international au premier rang. Aujourd'hui, 4% seulement de l'aide publique au développement, 4% sont consacrés à l'agriculture, alors que 75% des pays, des personnes pauvres vivent en milieu rural. C'est la Banque mondiale, dans un rapport très intéressant et assez nouveau, qui disait il y a à peu près un an et demi qu'un dollar investi dans l'agriculture, c'était le dollar le plus efficace contre la pauvreté. Et on a vu un changement d'état d'esprit grâce à cet appel de la Banque mondiale, à cause notamment des émeutes de la faim dans plusieurs manifestations internationales, le sommet de Rome en 2008, le G8, le G20 plus récemment à Pittsburgh, qui va dans le bon sens, et voilà comment les pays les plus riches ont décidé de mobiliser 22 milliards de dollars sur 3 ans pour l'agriculture. Deuxième conviction, les marchés agricoles ont besoin de régulation. Ma conviction, mesdames et messieurs, c'est que si le commerce suffisait pour lutter contre la faim dans le monde, si le commerce suffisait pour nourrir l'Afrique, on le saurait. Le commerce ne suffit pas. Et pour nourrir ces pays et leur donner une capacité, je ne dis pas autonome, encore moins autarcique, mais une vraie capacité de se nourrir, il faut des politiques agricoles et un certain nombre de règles, de régulation, voire de protection. Voilà, je pense que c'est aussi une des leçons que nous avons tirées, que de construire ou de reconstruire des outils de régulation pour faire face tout simplement à la volatilité des marchés agricoles. Et quand je parle de régulation, je parle d'un sujet que nous avons traité au niveau du G8 en Italie il y a quelques mois, qui est celle de la gestion coordonnée des stocks, notamment des stocks alimentaires, comme d'ailleurs un grand pays, un immense pays comme l'Inde, est en train de l'organiser avec ses voisins. Troisième leçon, à laquelle je tiens beaucoup, que j'ai développé dans ce petit livre, c'est celle d'une approche régionale de l'économie agricole. Au nom de quoi, mesdames et messieurs, au nom de quoi les États-Unis d'Amérique et tous les États qui les constituent, au nom de quoi les pays européens, les 27 nations européennes qui forment l'Union européenne, auraient-ils le droit de construire des politiques régionales agricoles, d'avoir des protections, de gérer en commun un certain nombre de défis, et les pays les plus pauvres n'ont-ils pas ce droit? Donc moi je plaide, non pas pour du protectionnisme, mais simplement pour que ces pays mettent en commun, qu'on les aide fortement à mettre en commun, à mutualiser un certain nombre d'actions publiques. Je pense à la gestion de l'eau, je pense à la gestion des risques climatiques, les criquets ou sanitaires, tous les pathogènes émergents qui vont nous exploser à la figure dans le monde entier, en raison du réchauffement climatique ou des transports. Je pense à la répartition des productions, aux stocks que je viens d'évoquer. Voilà un certain nombre de sujets que les pays d'une même région, Afrique de l'Ouest, Afrique de l'Est, Afrique centrale, Amérique latine, peut-être la Caraïbe, auraient intérêt à mettre ensemble, comme nous avons eu intérêt à les mettre ensemble au niveau du continent européen, où je parle des États-Unis. Je veux saluer de ce point de vue-là le travail qui est fait par la CDAO, par exemple, assez en avance dans la construction d'une politique régionale en Afrique. Quatrième et dernier exemple, un exemple concret sur lequel nous ne pouvons pas rester silencieux, qui est celui des programmes d'acquisition de terres agricoles par des investisseurs publics ou privés. On peut avoir des inquiétudes ou des questions quand on voit des surfaces considérables, parfois des millions d'hectares, être achetées par des pays ou des groupes qui ont de l'argent dans certains pays les plus pauvres. Ça peut être positif dans certains cas, mais moi je pense qu'il y a des conséquences graves économiques et sociales. Et tout simplement pour la souveraineté de ces pays, je pense que les organisations mondiales, les bailleurs de fonds, devraient être attentifs à cette régulation-là pour sécuriser le foncier agricole dans les pays en développement. C'est aussi une demande que j'ai entendue de la part des organisations paysannes africaines bien avant cette réunion. C'est une question de gouvernance mondiale. La conclusion, mesdames et messieurs, puisqu'un homme politique comme je suis, un homme politique, il ne faut pas se contenter de diagnostic ou de photographie, il faut tirer des leçons, c'est ce que nous avons fait en Europe dans cette conférence, c'est que nous devons avancer des propositions, je dis bien des propositions, avec chacune et chacun des acteurs dans le monde, pour une nouvelle gouvernance dans le monde. Je pense que l'amélioration de la sécurité alimentaire mondiale, dans le long terme, non seulement exige des efforts en termes d'aide, en volume, en efficacité, volume d'aide alimentaire ou d'aide, mais également de la qualité des politiques et une plus grande cohérence des politiques. Voilà pourquoi nous, mon pays, la France, l'Union européenne vont travailler à cette nouvelle gouvernance mondiale, une gouvernance agricole internationale. De quoi parle-t-on? Non pas d'une institution nouvelle, il y a déjà la FAO qui existe, mais j'observe, mesdames et messieurs, ce sera l'idée que je mets dans le débat, qu'il n'y a aucun lieu et pas beaucoup de moments où les grands acteurs du monde, les grands bailleurs, les institutions, les pays, parlent ensemble d'un certain nombre de questions qui ne sont pas seulement des questions de commerce, comme on les traite à l'OMC, à l'Organisation mondiale du commerce, qui touche à ce que je viens d'évoquer, les politiques régionales agricoles, la production agricole, la capacité de produire de manière souveraine, des questions qui sont extrêmement sérieuses, comme la place et le rôle des biocarburants, ou la question que j'ai évoquée également de la souveraineté foncière. Je pense qu'il manque un lieu et des moments pour débattre ensemble autour de la même table de ces questions, et nous pensons que ce devrait être le comité de la sécurité alimentaire, rattaché notamment à la FAO et en liaison avec les Nations Unies. Je pense même que pour aider à la réflexion de ce comité de sécurité alimentaire au plus haut niveau, il devrait y avoir, un peu comme on l'a fait sur le climat, avec le GIEC, le groupement d'experts de très haut niveau, et qui a bien fonctionné sur le climat, pour aboutir aux décisions de Kyoto et, j'espère, celles de Copenhague, un groupe d'experts de haut niveau de questions agronomiques, de recherche, d'agriculture ou de sécurité sanitaire. Voilà. Il y a bientôt, en novembre, un grand sommet à Rome, organisé par la FAO sur toutes ces questions. Nous avons une date pour ce partenariat mondial, nous avons une date pour cette nouvelle gouvernance mondiale en matière d'alimentation et d'agriculture. Voilà pourquoi je vous dis, je trouve que cette conférence de Madrid University tombe bien au bon moment pour préparer et jalonner le chemin vers, j'espère, des résultats concrets à Rome. Merci de votre attention.
Merci M. Barnier d'avoir lancé notre réflexion dans des pistes très fertiles. Next on our list is the Honorable Michael Chong, who is a Member of Parliament who was first elected in 2004 for the riding of Wellington Halton Hills in Ontario. He has served as President of the Queen's Privy Council, Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs, and Minister for Sports. He also has done work for the National Hockey League Players Association, the Toronto Airport Authority, and has founded an institute devoted to raising public awareness about history and civics. So a broadly interested person that comes to this issue also with a sense of the political implications of these issues. So, Mr. Wong, please.
Mr. Chong, sorry.
Merci. Monsieur Barnier a commencé en français. Parce que nous sommes un pays bilingue, je vais continuer en anglais. So I'll do my discourse in English. Thank you very much to the Dean for having me here today and for Miguel for hosting this conference yet again. So thank you very much and welcome to all of the participants. So today we were asked to talk about food security in the context of the global recession and the challenges that we face as a world, as citizens on this planet, ensuring that humanity has adequate access to food. Food's a unique part of our economy. Foundational to food is agriculture, and agriculture is unlike any other sector in the economy. And it's unique for two reasons. First, agriculture and the production of food involves an immovable asset, land. And land is inherently tied to the concept of territorial sovereignty in the construct of the nation state. So unlike manufacturing, where you have plant capital equipment that you can literally pick up and move to another location, or in the services sector, where you can literally locate offices anywhere you want. So if you're in high tech, you could move from Silicon Valley to Bangalore in India. If you're in finance, you could move your office and your back office operations from New York to Hong Kong. These things are portable, but agriculture is not portable like other sectors are, because it involves land, and land is tied up with territorial sovereignty, but it's also an immovable asset. The second reason why food and agriculture are unique is that it involves something that's foundational to our societies. Food has allowed us to establish civilization, allowed us to move from groups of people that chase after our food to being people who settle in the spot and develop higher functions of work and rest and leisure. And so I like to tell people that food is so important, and that a country like Cuba, that has survived 5 decades without the importation of American automobiles, wouldn't survive 5 weeks without food. And I think that illustrates the importance of food and why the discussion and the debate around topics like this are so important. I've come to the conclusion that the problem around agriculture is largely an economic one. Not entirely. Clearly, technological advances are going to play a role in the future production and the future challenges that we have in global food supply. For example, in areas where that are subject to droughts, we have to develop better varieties of drought-resistant seeds and crops, especially as the climate continues to evolve and especially as parts of the world start to experience some of the ravages of climate change. But in many respects, we have a problem with the economics of food. For example, today I was listening to the news and I heard that in Belgium, dairy farmers are on the streets rioting. Why? Because the price they're getting for their milk is only 75% of its production cost. Here, a similar situation in dairy exists south of the border, just a couple hundred kilometers south of here in the United States. A similar situation exists. Milk producers cannot sell their milk at cost if they're selling it far below cost. Here, this past summer in Canada, pork and beef farmers are facing an economic situation where they have to sell their products far below the cost of production. So this isn't unique to Europe, it isn't unique to North America, it's a situation we find ourselves in around the world. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Canadian situation because I'm most familiar with it, but I think by illustrating the details and illustrating the Canadian situation, we can draw parallels to the challenges we face in the developing world. Over the last number of decades, farming in Canada has become wholly unprofitable. It's not profitable from any point of view and simply should not exist, and we as a nation, as a state, have had high levels of production for decades now despite this unprofitability. But what we are starting to see now in Canada are the early signs, in my view, of a hollowing out of a productive capacity. Just a little example. In Ontario, the number of cattle produced in Ontario, the number of cattle in Ontario, is 2.5 million. That is the lowest number of cattle in the province of Ontario since 1940. So after a decade of unprofitability in the beef sector due to a number of factors, BSC being one, but a whole number of issues, trade restrictions and the like, overproduction south of the border, a whole number of other issues came into play. After 10 years of unprofitability in the beef sector, we are starting now to see the hollowing out of that sector in Ontario. And I think similar situations have happened in Africa over the last number of decades where, for example, because of world food subsidies and world food donations not being tied in their donations have led to dumping of foodstuffs into places like Africa that have outcompeted the local farmer. And over the course of decades, we've seen a hollowing out of Africa's food production capacity as well. So these two parallels are at their heart. The problem with these two parallels are at their heart economic. Over the last 10 years, Canada's 230,000 farms generated about $2 billion in profit in a typical year on about $40 billion in sales. While this may seem like a healthy sector, $2 billion in profit or net income divided amongst 230,000 farms is an average profit of $8,500 per farm. These numbers are even worse when you realize that most farmers and their farm families don't pay themselves and rely on this profit as their salary. In addition, farm and farm businesses make major investments, and for many the return on investment has been less than what they would earn in a savings account. That is why the vast majority of farm families in Canada make ends meet by working off-farm. 30 years ago, the profit situation was much better. In 1974, Canada's farming sector generated, in present dollars, about $16.5 billion on $38 billion in sales. In other words, in the last number of years, Canadian farmers have made about a third of the profit they made 30 years ago, and the last number of years have been better than they were 5-10 years ago. This drop in income during the last 30 years has occurred despite an increase in our country's population from 22 to 32 million, and an increase in productive capacity. We've heard much about the manufacturing crisis in North America and in Europe, so I think it's good to draw parallels to illustrate the gravity of the lack of profitability in the farming sector. In 2007, Canada's manufacturing sector generated $45 billion in profit on $600 billion in revenues. So compare that to $2 billion in profit on $40 billion in sales. Manufacturing's margins over the last number of years were about 7.5%, 8%, while agriculture's have been less than 5%. So which sector, I ask you, is in bigger trouble, and which one is driving bigger headlines? Another compare and contrast is with the gambling sector. Last year, in Canada, gambling and gaming accounted for close to $9 billion in profit. That's about four times the profit that the Canadian agricultural sector made in the last decade. I think there's something wrong, inherently wrong, with the setup of the society when the gambling and gaming sector makes four times as much as the entire sector that puts food on your table. So clearly, at a macroeconomic level in Canada, farm economic policies are not working. So what's the cause of this lack of profitability, not just here in Canada, but abroad? One problem is that input costs continue to rise. The cost of fertilizers, diesel fuel, pesticides, herbicides, seed inputs continue to rise. Food standards continue to go up. These all create higher baseline costs for farmers. Another problem is a result of the Green Revolution, a huge increase, massive increase in productivity, farm productivity, resulting in huge increases in the number and amounts of commodities being produced. Yet, still another problem rests in the fact that many governments around the world continue to provide subsidies and support for their farmers, and our government is no exception, causing huge overproduction of foodstuffs and dumping of foodstuffs into the developing world below the cost of production. So what are some of the solutions to this lack of profitability? Some will argue that science and technology are the solutions, but my view is that the solution will not be found in greater productivity gains. My guess is that the greatest productivity gains have been had in the last 50 years, and no other sector of our economy has had the kind of productivity gains that farming has. Any additional gains, in my view, would not be sufficient to compensate for the drop in farm income, and would likely only be achieved on larger and larger farm operations, leaving little room for local operators. Others say the solution lies in greater trade liberalization by eliminating import restrictions. The problem with this is that many governments have been reluctant to move down that path and to eliminate trade-distorting policies, and I think the recent Doha round of trade negotiations are a good case in point. One solution clearly is for the developed world to eliminate trade-distorting aid programs like Tide Food Aid. And one of the things I'm quite proud that our government has done is untie all of our food aid. So in 2008, the government of Canada decided to completely untie, for the first time in 50 years, completely untie all of its food aid that it provides for through the World Food Program and other programs around the world. And as a result, we believe, by giving this money directly through organizations like the World Food Program or directly to states involved themselves, they can then purchase the foodstuffs locally, creating local markets and incentivizing local farmers to producing local crops. So what are some of the other potential solutions? I think we need to focus less on the science of agriculture and more on the economics of agriculture. As an elected member of parliament, one of the things I often get asked in an area in which I live, which is still largely agricultural, is how do we get younger people into farming? And my response to them is simple: make farming profitable, and younger farmers will enter the sector. Make farming profitable in Africa, and you will see an increase in the number of farmers and an attention to the land and attention to producing food. So universities and think tanks, institutes and farm organizations need to focus on this fundamental question. You look at the big agricultural research universities in this country, whether they be the University of Saskatchewan, University of Guelph, McGill University, and traditionally, over the last number of decades, they have focused on the science of agriculture, but put very little effort and discussion into the economics of agriculture. So I commend McGill for doing this conference now for a number of years, because I think this is a much neglected area of study, and I think a lot more debate and a lot more dialogue could happen in this area, and I think it would produce huge results for the world. Governments also have a role to play. Governments also need to address the fundamental problem of low farm incomes. Ultimately, the solution to low farm incomes is not going to come from greater efficiencies or lower input costs, but from higher revenue. And that higher revenue must come from somewhere, whether that be from governments or from consumers. This can be accomplished by reducing subsidies, by reducing subsidies abroad, or by subsidizing domestic industry directly, or by imposing tariffs on imports. But ultimately, any solution to the lack of profits in the farming sector will mean that consumers will have to pay a little more for food. And in Africa, I think there's a good parallel to be drawn here. When our government decided to untie its food aid, what we were in effect doing was allowing local producers in Africa and around the world to get a little more for the stuff they sold to the people who had received our dollars. And that, in turn, ensured that local farmers and local production was enhanced. In Canada, consumers only pay 10% of their household budgets on food. That's down from 20% as recently as the late 1960s. So 10% of our households today spend their budgets, 10% of our household budgets today are spent on food, a phenomenally low number. In the context of civilization, when you think about the broad sweep of civilization, the fact that a typical citizen in this society only has to work till about the middle of February in order to provide all the food they need for the entire 12 months of the calendar year, that is a phenomenal accomplishment, and I think points to the fact that our technology and our production has increased dramatically. And so clearly, enhancing production and enhancing technology isn't going to get us to where we need to be in terms of profitability of farming. Let me finish by raising one final point. One question many ask is, if other areas of the world can produce food cheaper, why not let them? Why do we need to produce food in Canada? Why does Africa need to produce food? Why does food need to be produced locally at all if we can produce it cheaper elsewhere and import it to serve our markets? My response is simple. No country, no civilization has survived long without the ability to produce its own food. History has shown that a society's ability to survive is linked to the security and certainty of its food supply. This food supply is at too great a risk of disruption from trade wars, from other threats, if a state relies exclusively on imports. Obviously, certain foodstuffs will always be exported and imported. We can't grow bananas or oranges in Canada, and so obviously if we want to eat those foodstuffs, we're going to have to import them. But basic foodstuffs that can be grown in a locality should be grown in a locality, especially as we contemplate an era of climate change and ever-rising energy costs. I leave you with one last question to contemplate. In Canada, as in many other developed countries, we shield our airlines, our cable companies, our telephone companies, our newspapers, our healthcare, and our cultural sector. These are all protected because they are considered essential to our national interest. The question I leave it with you today is, what is more vital to a state's interest than the certainty and security of its own domestic food supply? Thank you.
Merci, M. Chung, d'avoir fait le lien entre le local et l'expérience canadienne et puis la réalité et les défis mondiaux de la sécurité alimentaire. We now pass to someone that perhaps will have a more global outlook on this issue without necessarily anchoring it in the experience of one given country. Hafez Ghanem is the Assistant Director General, Economic and Social Development Department, Department at the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, has been so since 2007, prior to which he had a long career at the World Bank as a country director for Nigeria, for Madagascar, Comoros, Mauritius, and the Seychelles, and he has also worked in the area of Europe and Central Asia at the World Bank. Mr. Gallenby is a trained economist, and so perhaps a less political intervention this time.
Merci beaucoup. Je voudrais dire deux mots en français, après ça je passerai en anglais, puisque j'ai préparé ma présentation en anglais. Et je voudrais tout d'abord remercier ma guide de m'avoir invité et de le remercier pour l'organisation de ces conférences sur ce sujet tellement important. Par contre, je pense que me demander de parler après deux grands orateurs comme M. Barnier et M. Chong ne veut pas plaisir. I will make three points in my presentation. First point is that we're talking about hunger in the world today, but actually we have to remember that this is not a new phenomenon, that this is a structural problem in the world. That we have a serious long-run problem of hunger in the world. Second point that I would make is that the food, financial, and fuel crisis that we have been going through has made the problem worse. But in some sense, it has also attracted people's attention to a problem that has been existing for a long time. And the third and last point I'm going to make is a point that was made by Michel Barnier also, is the importance of investment in agriculture. Especially when we look ahead, not just to see what is happening now, but if you look ahead for the next four decades towards the year 2050, how will we feed the world unless we invest much, much more than what we are going to do now? So those are the three points. I thought since I was given only 10 minutes, I'll tell you what I'm going to say just in case something happens. In my presentation, I'll use the word hunger or undernourishment interchangeably. I use hunger to be defined as people having less calorie intake than what is required to lead a healthy life with some light activity given their age and their height. So this is using definitions and data for the required caloric intake that the WHO provides. Now, let me first quickly make the point that hunger is really a structural problem. It's not something that just started in 2007. In 1996, the world leaders met in Rome and committed themselves to reduce the number of hungry people in the world by half before 2015. In 1996, FAO estimated that the number of hungry people in the world was 830 million. That is, 14% of the world's population was undernourished. 10 years later, in 2005, 2006, before any crisis, when food prices were low, when the world economy was growing, the number of hungry people was actually 850 million. So the numbers actually increased rather than decreased. And it's true that this 850 million constituted 13% of the world's population, not 14% as in 1996. Where do all those hungry people live? The largest number of undernourished people in the world live in Asia. 504. At the time, I'm using the 2005 numbers before I move to discuss what happened with the crisis. 540 million people in Asia. And that represents 16% of the population. Then comes sub-Saharan Africa, 212 million people at that time hungry in course, the number, the absolute figures for sub-Saharan Africa are lower than Asia because there are less people in sub-Saharan Africa than Asia. But the 212 million Africans represent 30% of the population. So one-third, roughly, of Africa's population is estimated to be undernourished. Latin America, 45 million people, which is 8% of the population, and the Near East and North Africa, 33 million people, which is also 8% of the population. The remaining 20 million people are in rich countries, because actually there are pockets of undernourishment even in developed countries. So this was the situation. We had a lot of undernourishment and hunger in the world, or a lot. Then the food and fuel crisis started. It started in 2007 and peaked in 2008. By August 2008, the food price index that FAO produces every month was 61% higher than 2006. So prices on average of food products grew by two-thirds roughly over a two-year period. Now, this FAO food price index measures prices of the world markets. We also measure prices in developing countries. We've been collecting data in local markets in 60 developing countries. And whereas some countries, China is a good example, have been able to cushion the impact of the world prices on their domestic markets, this has not been the case for the majority of developing countries in the world. According to the data we have from local markets, we just collected data for key staples, and their prices had risen by 59% on the local markets. The key staples that I'm talking about are mainly wheat, maize, rice, lentils. If you imagine in a poor developing country, the price of a key staple increases by roughly 60%, when a typical poor household will be spending 20 to 40% of its income on this key staple. So it has been a huge shock. And of course, this shock led to an increase in the number of hungry people. So now it went from 850 million to a little bit more than 900 million, around 920 million in 2007-2008. And who were the people who were most affected by this increase in price? Actually, surprisingly, at least for me, we found that most of the rural populations were greatly affected by the increase in food prices. I say surprisingly for me because you would have expected that those are the people producing food. So if the prices were up, they should be better off. But then 70% of rural households in developing countries are food deficit. They are net buyers of food in the market. And those people were hurt. Second group of people who were hurt, I go back to this point. So what we found surprising, we're looking here at household level data that we collect. What we found surprising is that we expected the shock to be mainly in urban areas. And yes, it's true, the urban poor were hurt. And there the most rioted and the food riots and so on that we saw in the newspapers were all coming from the urban areas. But actually, we had more people being hurt in rural areas than in urban areas. The other group, category of household that was particularly hurt by this increase in prices, are female-headed households. Because female-headed households, typically in developing countries, have much less much less control over resources, and at the same time, they tend to spend a larger proportion of their income on food and nutrition for their children. So, this was the situation in 2008. Then came the financial and economic crisis. As Michel Barnier said, it was a crisis of demand. Demand declined. And that led to lower prices of every commodity around the world, including food commodities. So prices, our food price index in August 2009 was 23% lower than a year earlier. And it was still 24% above 2006, but at least it's a big decline compared to where it was at the peak in 2008. One would think that this would have helped reduce hunger. I mean, it went up when prices went up, so if prices come down, it should help reduce hunger. But actually what we found, working with the World Food Programme, that although prices came down, they still remained high. On average, in developing countries, staple food prices today are more than 20%, in real terms, corrected for inflation, are more than 20% higher than in 2006. So they did come down. They were 59% higher before. Now they're only 20% higher. But at the same time, people's incomes fell. And people's incomes fell more than the fall in prices. For the poorest people in developing countries, the sources, the way the financial crisis affected them directly was remittances. Many households in developing countries depend on remittances, and those declined dramatically. They were affected because the prices of their export commodities went down. They were affected because also there was less investment and less jobs available. As a result of all of that, this year, 2009, we're estimating that we have more than a billion people suffering from undernourishment in the world. And these are not just estimates, those are not just numbers. This year, together with the World Food Programme, we did 5 in-depth country studies where we go and actually sit with the families and see in detail what has been happening. And this was work done mainly by the World Food Programme colleagues. And the 5 countries that they looked at are Armenia, Bangladesh, Ghana, Nicaragua, and Zambia. So these were not just African countries, it was all over. And what they have found is that in all those countries, the first reaction for a family that's losing income is to try to protect its food budget. So those people have been cutting lots of their expenses, especially on things like healthcare, education. But then, in most cases, they've also been cutting back on their food in 2 ways. Reducing the number of meals that they take a day. And the second way is shifting the types of food. So much less fruits and vegetables and meat, and much more carbohydrates, more grains. So in addition to having lower overall caloric intake, they also have a less balanced diet. So it's not just a problem of being hungry, but also a problem of malnutrition. Now, let me move to my third and last point about about the importance of investment in agriculture. So how can we explain our failure to ensure food security? And I believe that really the answer is that we have neglected agriculture for such a long time. Let me give you just two figures. Between 1975 and 1990, the capital stock in agriculture, the global capital stock in agriculture, was growing at about 1.1% every year. Between 1991 and 2007, this rate of growth fell by more than half. It was 0.5%. This is just one piece of one number that gives you an indication of the neglect for the sector. At the same time, official development assistance, which was at 17%, agriculture share of official development assistance, which was at 17% in 1980, fell to 4% in 2006. Actually, a little bit less than 4%. The same thing happened in developing countries. It's not just that the donors shifted the resources out of agriculture, but especially the governments shifted the resources out of agriculture. As you heard, I was director of the World Bank, and why was I funding less agricultural projects when I was at the World Bank? Because the governments I was working with were not asking for them. So there was a general lack of interest. Now, how can we explain that? Well, two things. One issue, the reason the private sector was investing less in agriculture is really the reason that Mr. Chung explained. It was not profitable. But why did the public sector not invest in agriculture? And actually, at the time, there were many arguments. We were saying, listen, the hunger problem is really a poverty problem. There is no issue of, there is enough food in the world. The problem is that people cannot buy it, that poor people cannot buy it. So what we should be doing is really developing anti-poverty programs, and people will go out and buy the food, and hunger will disappear. It does sound like a sensible thing to say, but in fact, if 75% of poor people live in rural areas and their livelihoods is directly or indirectly linked to agriculture, how can you fight poverty without investing in agriculture? The fact of the matter is, we're actually at FAO organizing a conference similar to yours that will start exactly this coming Monday, and the title is How to Feed the World in 2050. And we've been doing lots of background papers for that conference, and one of those papers actually goes and looks at, compares countries that have succeeded in reducing hunger with countries that have not. And it's amazing that the correlation that you find between investment in agriculture and the rate of reduction of hunger. So there is a lot of empirical evidence that shows that you cannot fight hunger unless you invest in agriculture. Now, if you look to the future, this is the story so far. If you look to the future, I mean, my hope is that the future will be much better, because I see lots of signs of things changing in terms of the problem of hunger, undernourishment, the issue of agriculture taking center stage again in the development debate. But if we look at the future, and you look at 2050, in 2050, the world's population will exceed 9 billion. We are now 6 point something billion. So the world's population will be higher than what it is now by one third. There is I picked 2050 as a reference, because at that point, according to the demographic projections that one sees, the population will reach a plateau. at least the rate of growth would be much, much slower. So we're going to have an additional 3 billion people in the world, 34%. Where will those people be? Is the population growing in Canada? Is it growing in France or Germany? All those 3 billion people are going to be in developing countries. Now, according to our estimates, our lower bound estimate, you need to increase food production by 70% if you are going to feed all those people. Now, this increase, I say lower bound, because we're just looking at how much food needs to be available, not how much agriculture needs to be growing, because we don't know how much biofuels are going to grow. So, I mean, if you grow agriculture by 70%, but half of that goes to biofuels, then you're in trouble. So, then that means that you would need to do much more. Now, what we did is analyze, ask ourselves, does the world, can we produce enough this additional 70% food? Or was Malthus right after all? And the answer we came to is yes, we can. There are enough resources, there is enough technology, it is possible, and I think it is extremely likely that we will be able to produce this 70% additional food and feed everybody in the world. However, this will require a big jump in agricultural investments. We calculate just for primary agriculture that for developing countries they need to invest $55 billion a year for primary agriculture. For everything else around agriculture, the investment rate, annual investment rate, should be would be more than $200 billion a year in gross terms, which is $84 billion in net terms. But let me just stick with one number. $55 billion a year that need to be invested every year in developing country agriculture to meet this objective of feeding everybody by 2050. How much are they investing today? $33 billion. So we have an investment gap of roughly two-thirds. The difference between 33 and 55. So, I hope I convinced you. And now, this is how we see the problem. It's an old problem, and we think the cause is this neglect for agriculture. We believe that we need to increase investment in agriculture. That investment is not just governments or donors. Most of the investment in agriculture is done by farmers themselves. And that means that it's not just putting money, but it's also putting all the institutions, the policies, whether they are domestic policies, trade policies, and so on. But you've already heard about those, and I will not go into in great details. Now, what one should be optimistic, because what, as I said before, we see a big change in people's perceptions about the importance of the sector. We see a lot, much more political will to tackle the problem. And I feel that really the when I read the declaration of the G8 summit at L'Aquila on food security, I felt that it was a major shift and really an excellent step in the right direction. Because if we want to tackle this problem, if we want to avoid that the number of hungry people in the world continue increasing, we need to act now. Thank you very much.
Merci, Monsieur Ganem.
now my pleasure to welcome His Excellency Professor Iyawusi Haga, who is the Nigerian High Commissioner to Canada, and who has a trajectory that's a little bit different perhaps from our previous speakers. He was for several years a professor of theater in Nigeria, a poet, a writer, and maybe the real answers will come from the poets. He was also a politician in Nigeria, serving as the Deputy Chief Whip, Whip in the Nigerian Senate, was also Minister of State Power and Steel, and also Minister of Health before becoming Nigerian Ambassador to Mexico. And in all these functions, he incorporated his interest and knowledge about theater and poetry to advance, you know, the fight against AIDS and other important causes. So perhaps now we'll learn how theater can help us bring about food security. Exactly.
Good evening. Great pleasure to stand before you to share my thoughts and concerns on how public policy, political development affect food security, especially in my country, Nigeria. And I would like to give a little confession before I give you my paper. Since the last time I was here, the first Miguel Food Security Conference, I have felt more and more insecure, and that insecurity was not lessened when soon after the food security conference there was a global collapse of the world economy, and that led to more insecurity. I was also in that period keener to understand the dynamics of what food security means to me, and that has worsened my fear about the consequences and the possibilities of our food insecurity as how it affects all of us here. Because I used to think of food security as a state of being simply well fed, and I make sure I eat three times a day. But I'm not sure of that anymore. And today, as we look at the interpretation and the definition of food security by the FAO, which simply states that food must be available, must be accessible, must be acceptable, and must be adequate, I want to add another dimension to this definition. Not just the availability, accessibility, acceptability, and adequacy, but the happinessability of food. Each time we sit in a dining table or are confronted with food in today's world, we are panic-stricken. We start thinking of the calories, the good carbs, the good fats, the bad fats. Then we begin to wonder, because from time to time major catastrophes would happen because the food chains are endemically incompetent. And so we begin to wonder about E. coli, Salmonella, bird flu, swine flu, and there is no end to it. So sitting with you here, I don't know about you, but me, I feel more and more food insecure. And so I intend to share with you the fact that Africa and my country Nigeria have had a lot of experience of food insecurity, but that we are beginning now to tackle certain aspects of food security, and not least of this is good policies, public governance, good practices, and democracy. The food security problems of sub-Saharan Africa have truly become for us a weapon of mass destruction, as has been mentioned by my other panel members. We are all too familiar with the media images of Africa and their starving millions. Perhaps what we need to reinforce is the fact that all conventional measures, sub-Saharan Africa, is the painful synthesis of all the human sufferings that the world is now used to. More than half of the population lives in extreme poverty, and it is the only place on earth where most people are getting poorer and where health and education are deteriorating. In sub-Saharan Africa, 6 million children die after their fifth birthday. One third of these children that survive are severely malnourished. And even those that survive death and malnourishment, one third goes without primary education and two thirds without university, college, polytechnic, monotechnics, or any tertiary education. Agriculture in Africa has grown at the average of only 2% since 1960. And over 1 million Africans are severely food insecure because their caloric intake is not adequate for basic nutrition. The sad and pathetic history of Africa cannot be fully appreciated without the understanding of the dynamics of its geopolitics and its public policies and political developments. The complexities of the lost decades of the 80s, and I'm not getting into IMF and all that it stood for because my friend from the World Bank is sitting there. But I am not even going to talk about the bad stories of Africa. I'm here to talk to you about hope. And the hope I intend to enkindle in you is the fact that there's a growing consensus in Africa that a new thinking and new actions will give birth to a new Africa, whose constructive change is desperately needed. The African Union, through its African grown economic prince named NEPAD and its peer review mechanism, have indicated a definite shift in paradigm. So there is a new narrative that Africa is anxious that the world be aware of. And of all the African countries that have made this paradigm shift, the least known is my country, Nigeria. And that is why you have an unusually high Nigerian delegation led by the governor of the state of Benue, which is the food basket of Nigeria, to bring our narrative. And I'm happy that Professor Ozo spoke earlier in the day about that shift. It is important that Nigeria has made this shift because of its commanding presence in African affairs, as a peace builder and indeed as a donor nation in Africa. Nigeria's failure is something the world has agonized over, because if 150 million were to belong to a failed state, and it would just swarm the rest of West Africa and the rest of Africa. So it is of concern that Nigeria does not fail, and we thank God we are beginning to see some hope or the glimmer to that success story. And that is what I intend in the next few minutes to tell you, because on the 29th of May 1999, Nigeria made that paradigm shift and embraced democracy after 30 years of military rule. And those of you who have been democracies do not understand what military rule is. It's a rule that is characterized by arbitrariness. It is a rule that suspends the constitution, and therefore there are no laws. So everything goes. And therefore, corruption reigned for many years. Now, a new thinking has taken place that only a democratic system can fully provide justice and food security for all. New actions have been taken to combat corruption, and a new future is beckoning. Nigeria is Africa's largest market and the second largest economy. And it is making this shift not simply because of its size, but because the present government has guaranteed the policies of access to profit repatriation and concessions to new business, and the economy has grown steadily since 1999 from 6.7% to 8% between 2007-2009. Corruption, which had eaten deep, is being fought, because when there is corruption, especially when you have oil and there's corruption, nobody invests on the farm. We take the money from the oil, which does not need one single farmer. Oil company comes to the high seas, sets up the rigs, takes the money, pays rents to the government. The government sells the money and eats it up. All oil producing countries, the first victim is agriculture. But democratic rule has been kind to Nigeria. Reforms in public policy led to Nigeria reducing its external debt from $36 billion to just $3.7 billion, moving from being the most indebted African nation to now one of its few creditor nations. Our country is still the 11th largest oil producer and the 7th largest world reserves of natural gas. Our country was also, before 1999, the second most corrupt country on earth. And within this short period, today Nigeria, by the Transparency International Corrupt Perception Index, has moved from that second most corrupt country out of 188, we're 186. Today we are 121. So democracy has been good and it's going to get a lot better. Of the policies that have yielded important benefits to Nigeria's food security portfolio, while agricultural growth for the rest of Africa has been 2.2%, Nigeria today has, the agriculture has grown by 5.6%, higher than the average of sub-Saharan Africa. And when the president, Yar'Adua, our current president, became president, his 7-point agenda, the most important one was food security. And within 3 years, he has done an amazing thing. He took a look at all the previous policies of government and realized what was really missing. Because agriculture employs 70% of Nigerian population. And the previous administration were too busy sharing the oil money, and food production was in the hands of poor peasants who suffered from many things: chronic lack of farm inputs, improved seed, improved breeds, feeds, fertilizer, and agrochemicals. Agricultural technology remained rudimentary, relying on back-breaking old traditional agricultural system. And most of the rural farmers had no access to the markets, roads, schools, or enabling infrastructure. They were often victims of drought, erosion, fires, and incessant ethnic and religious crises, as well as clashes between farmers and cattle rearers. Agriculture was a high-risk occupation with inadequate protection against pests and diseases of crops and animals. All this made agriculture an unprofitable venture, and all who could run away from it actually ran away. The high cost of input and low return on investment led to our youth abandoning the farms and running into the cities, leaving the farms in the hands of the aged. Abandoning of agriculture led to impoverishment of the people, while the population kept expanding and creating even more poverty. The lack of infrastructure and settlement patterns of the peasants made provisions for schools and health facilities difficult to access, and this led to even more poverty. Today, Nigeria is saying no to this. There is an agricultural revolution, and the government policy trust is anchored on a short, medium, and long-term trajectory to ensure access, availability, affordability of quality food to all Nigerians. A food security roadmap is on the table with participatory role for the federal, state, and local governments, as well as the private sector. And this roadmap has government as the regulator and the facilitator to set a direction to an improved agricultural sector that is driven by the private sector. The government aims at substantial import substitution, and within this period that we have achieved democracy, we have reduce our food imports that were 14.5% of our food requirements to now 7.4% in 2008. And of all the public policies and political development facing food security, there is none quite as radical and life-transforming as the liberalization of land ownership to make land transactions easier to execute and to enable farmers to use their lands as collateral to secure bank loans. From the above account, we see the leadership role that Nigeria has continued to play, and it is vitally important for Nigeria to succeed so that there will be a dominant effect that will help other African countries to succeed as well. We can see that the political development of the rest of Africa would be tied to what happens to Nigeria. Unfortunately, multilateral agreements in trade and investment threaten availability and accessibility of food. The reduction of world surpluses and increases in international prices, encouraged by the Uruguay round of the general GATT agreements on tariffs and trade, pose grave threat of food insecurity to regions like Nigeria and sub-Saharan Africa. We can see the Nigerian government determined efforts to guarantee availability, food security. On the other hand, the growing commoditization and globalization of agri-food systems, which seem to be driving food insecurity forward. Food grown locally is often exported, while thousands of local residents suffer hunger and malnutrition. Countries like Nigeria become severely disadvantaged by the structures of production, processing, distribution, and marketing set up by global food networks. In the globalized system, the future of food security looks grim. The population explosion, which is driving the increase in poverty, pushes up the propensity and growing potential of conflicts that undermine food security. We are faced with environmental degradation and accelerating reduction of biodiversity. Scientists warn of climate change, escalation of military spending over and above investment in agriculture. To all the above worrisome trends is a shocking trend that wealth and power are concentrated in the hands of the 1 billion people of North Atlantic. And so poverty pervades the rest, and food security will continue to be the major problem to devour this people. I have seen that if the trend does not change, those left out of the world's economic, financial and information systems will become more and more food secure and thus ready victims to terrorism, nuclear proliferators, narco traffickers, organized crimes, human traffickers, and to corruption. In 2008, the biggest threat to global food security was delivered a few weeks after this conference. It was the world's financial meltdown. This had its origin in rampant trading of exotic assets by European and American banks. The world's richest nations have created a financial crisis and have created greater food insecurity. They should also show us the way out of this. And I'm happy that the World Bank is already thinking of the ways out. What is even more important is that they should explain to the developing nations why free markets, light regulations, and privatizations are the only way to prosperity. If necessary, the West should lead in reinventing capitalism, where the market forces are not so blind and not too dumb to see and hear the cries of despair of those who suffer from food insecurity. I hope that that I have not made you, to share in despair and become as insecure as I was last year and still feel food insecure. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Hager. The law professor had been sensitive to the fact that it is the poet on the panel that underscores the centrality of the rule of law and the cancerous nature of corruption that can derail the greatest policy. We now come to the final speaker, Mr. David Malone, who is the president of the International Development Research Center, has been so since 2008, after serving as Canada's High Commissioner to India, and he was also previously a Canadian ambassador to the United Nations. He's served in various capacities in the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, and has written about the law of the UN as well as Indian foreign policy. Mr. Malone, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think essentially we're out of time, as many of you will have noticed in the room. So what I'll try to do is pick up on a few points that haven't been mentioned yet in the very interesting remarks of those who preceded me. Merci aux organisateurs de cette conférence. C'est une réussite remarquable d'avoir réussi à réunir autant d'experts sur une période de 3 journées ici à Montréal, et je suis très impressionné par leur succès. We've heard several times that the food security crisis somehow coincided with the economic crisis. In fact, of course, like the oil price spike, it preceded the economic crisis to an extent. It was the final phase of the pre-crisis bubble, in effect, the food security crisis of late 2007, early 2008. Canada's one of the very few countries that wasn't affected in any way by the food security crisis. We were focused on our stock returns. We were focused on the price of oil. We weren't focused on the price of food because, as was pointed out earlier, it's cheap for us Canadians relative to our incomes. And secondly, it hardly moved in Canada. In India, in early 2008, I bumped into Mrs. Gandhi, the leader of the governing coalition, and she had just been campaigning in Manipur, a distant state of India, from Delhi, and I asked her how that had been. She looked at me coldly and she said that was all about the price of tomatoes, because that's what politics in many poor countries are about. Politics are about the price of food, and we're barely aware of that in our country. Now, somehow Mrs. Gandhi must have convinced the electors in Manipur that she was dead serious about the price of tomatoes. I'm sure she was, because her party was re-elected in the state. But in India, throughout much of my time there, the single greatest subject of concern to politicians wishing to be re-elected was how to prevent further rises in the price of food. What caused the food price spike? Actually, very basic factors, economic factors in many ways, as Michael pointed out. First of all, agricultural productivity stopped growing. The Green Revolution occurred. We congratulated ourselves. We thought it was great. And as several speakers pointed out, we relaxed. Secondly, as productivity stopped growing, but populations continued to grow, and particularly rich segments of populations also growed, food stocks dropped. In fact, they dropped by 2/3 for sensitive commodities during the 10 years preceding the food price spike. No mystery that if you have very thin reserves, you're going to be much more vulnerable to instability in pricing than if you have big stocks. And we heard earlier about some initiatives to address the stocks factor. Third, commodities do run in packs. It isn't a coincidence that oil was rising while food prices were rising also. And it may well be, it hasn't been researched properly yet, that these were mutually reinforcing price rises. There's been some idea that speculation on what stocks there were may have played a large role in the price spike. It's under research for the moment. I think it would be a very brave proposition to argue that speculation had a great deal to do. Broader economic factors had a great deal more to do with the spike. Now, of course, along with the price of oil, as a result of the collapse of economic, of financial and other markets, the price of food collapsed also throughout much of the world. Again, Canadians were rather impervious to this reality elsewhere. The risk is that we'll be very complacent, because for some years now, 3, 4, 5 years, it would be rational to imagine prices will remain quite low for a variety of reasons. There's a lot less money available to buy food, for one. Now, the Green Revolution was built on false premises in many ways. Wonderful innovation in hybrid seeds, brought about not just by Dr. Borlaug, recently deceased, alas, but by many scientists in the developing world who are overlooked often in the story, but also by wildly irresponsible use of water in many countries, and also excessive use of frequently quite toxic fertilizers. And today we're beginning to pay a price for all of that excess, because soil has eroded in many of the parts of the developing world that were the richest, and water supplies, as we know, are simply not holding up enough. We have not spoken enough about water this evening, and here it's not enough to say that the rest of the world is responsible. Developing countries need to do a much better job of managing their own water resources than many of them are doing, just as the United States and many industrialized countries need to do better at managing their own water resources. Indeed, if we get out of this cyclical crisis on commodity pricing in the area of agriculture, it will be because there is shared effort by the developing world as well as effort in international institutions and in some of the countries that have more financial resources available. Climate change is having completely unpredictable effects on agriculture. We know it's having effects. We don't know, actually, if the long-term effects might be positive or negative. It's simply too new for us to know what the impacts will be. But the short-term impacts are very unsettling for farmers. They're very unsettling for poor populations, because we see floods we haven't yet learned how to manage. We see droughts we don't know how to counteract yet, partly because of very bad management of water, succeeding each other at a faster clip than has historically been the case. And there isn't much excuse, because we do know how we could deal with water management, and we also know how we could prevent the very negative effects of a number of droughts that are taking hold just as we speak, notably in East Africa, all over again. A final very big challenge for politicians, and we haven't spoken enough about politicians, although Mr. Bernier did and Michael touched on them, a very big problem for them in the developing world. If you look at how agriculture is done in the developing world, countries like Egypt, in countries like India. It's largely very small farm holdings, about as small as they can get. There's some agro business, but not a great deal of agro business. Most livelihoods that depend on farming depend on very small farms. The farms are barely sustainable as an economic proposition. They barely feed the families that depend on them. And obviously, if one could wave a magic wand to create employment for these families elsewhere than on their farms, larger farms would be part of the solution. But for politicians to convince small farmers that they need to think of farming differently, organize themselves differently, trust governments they've never had any reason to trust, trust new ideas they don't have much reason to trust, is extremely difficult for politicians to do. And that's one of the very big challenges ahead of us in the next 20 or 25 years, because we will not be able to continue with very small farm holdings to the extent that we have in many countries. Finally, George Bush said something last year that was very unpopular, but profoundly true. So I'll repeat it. What is the source of some of the problem in certain developing countries like China and India? The middle class is growing very fast. The middle class eats more than the poor, and the middle class wastes more than the poor, and the middle class eats meat, which consumes a great deal of other agricultural products to produce. And so demand is growing, not just because population figures are growing, but happily, people are more prosperous in much of the world, including some of the developing world. So this is an unpopular proposition, but it is true in a number of countries I've lived with. And we're going to have to think about how, as the world gets more prosperous, which is a good thing, we're going to manage to waste less, and we're going to manage to produce food that can sustainably be produced, including in terms of water management, to feed not only all these hungry mouths, but the increasingly picky mouths we're dealing with all over the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Malone. So I'm in the hands of the organizer, the chief of which is Nima Jumutu. I would suggest that we take a little bit of time to take full advantage of the richness of the experiences standing before you. So I would invite people who have questions to step up to the microphone, and we will take several questions all at once and then give a chance to the panelists to react. So we'll start at the front. Please make your questions relatively short.
We've heard technical and economic and political aspects, but I wonder about belief systems. It seems to me that we have a return, particularly in the West, of social Darwinism. The belief that certain populations deserve preferential treatment, and that there are too many people in the world, and that therefore these problems are something else and not our own. So what role do you think people's value systems and belief systems contribute to this unequal distribution of the world's wealth and food?
Thank you. We'll go on the back, please.
Okay. My question is about what is the impact of the new trend when big corporations buy 39% or less in another country, for example, Korea buying a big chunk of land in Madagascar, China buying a big chunk of land in Saudi, and the British buying a big chunk of agricultural land recently for commercial farming purposes.
Thank you. Maybe we'll take one last question at the front and then give a chance to answer.
Hank from the World Food Program. quite surprised that none of the speakers mentioned efficiency, if I'm not mistaken. Food security means to be able to lead a healthy and productive life. That is impossible without nutrition. We have 2 billion people, at least, probably more because of the high food prices and the global financial crisis, that suffer from micronutrient deficiencies. That is twice as much as the people who don't have enough calories to eat. How are we going to take care of the malnourished? And we have a double burden there. We also have high rates of obesity, which are probably similar amounts as the number of who have not enough calories to eat. Thank you.
So perhaps we proceed in the order of the initial presentations of Mr. Barnier, si vous avez des commentaires.
Faire une remarque à l'univers, si j'ai bien compris la première question. Parler de l'expérience des Européens, c'est peut-être mon avis de value, si je puis dire, dans ce débat. Nous avons fondé la politique régionale européenne agricole sur un genre de valeur qui reste juste pour l'avenir, c'est-à-dire un modèle alimentaire. Je dirai un mot de la nutrition après, un modèle alimentaire particulier qui est fondé sur la qualité, sur l'identité, l'authenticité des produits, sur une nourriture qui n'est pas aseptisée. Et puis le deuxième clé de notre modèle agricole, c'est celui de petites et moyennes exploitations. Je reviens à ce qu'il disait tout à l'heure. Ça ne vaut pas seulement pour les pays en développement, nous avons préservé en Europe un modèle de production agricole à partir de petites et moyennes exploitations. Je peux dire ça, moi j'ai été président d'une région de montagne, la Savoie, pendant 20 ans. Nous ne sommes pas dans un modèle d'industrie agricole. C'est ça qui a préservé la politique agricole commune. Une alimentation qui n'est pas aseptisée, fondée sur des signes de qualité, et puis de petites exploitations partout sur le territoire, et non pas de l'industrie agricole concentrée sur quelques régions. Et je donne acte, dernier intervenant de sa critique, qui est juste, je pense que vous avez raison, moi je pense que la politique de nutrition, au-delà de ce que peuvent faire les grands programmes des Nations Unies, c'est un des aspects de ce que j'appelle les politiques régionales que je souhaite, que j'appelle de mes voeux dans les régions les plus pauvres, pour mutualiser. Je pense que la bonne dimension pour mettre en place des politiques en faveur de la nutrition, de l'alimentation, de la qualité de l'alimentation, ce sont des politiques régionales au niveau de l'agriculture qui donneront plus de chance à l'action qu'au discours dans cette question de la nutrition.
Merci, M. Lechon, si vous voulez ajouter quelque chose.
Yeah, I think I'll address the third question, because the first one, I think, Mr. Bernier spoke to, and the second one I'm not at all familiar with. So on the third question of the issue of nutrition and the fact that there are 2 billion people who suffer from malnutrition, my view is that the problem we have is an economic one. And it was interesting to listen to some of the comments from some of the speakers today. One of the statistics that jumped out at me was that 75% or 70% of rural families in many of the places around the world that are suffering from malnutrition, from hunger, are rural families in rural areas that are predominantly agricultural. So in other words, they're not getting enough of an income from their labor to pay for the very food that they're producing. The High Commissioner from Nigeria mentioned that in some cases families and farm families in Western Africa were exporting food for global markets, but unable to purchase food, or unable to supply food for local markets because of the way the pricing of commodities was working. So I think while technology is going to play a role in increasing production, I think there's a lot of unused productive capacity out there, and that is a result of the fact that farming in many, many parts of the world is marginally profitable. So I think if you're going to try to address the malnutrition and lack of nutrition for these 800 million people, many of whom are rural, you have to address their income problem, and what is tightly tied to that income problem is the fact that farming in many of these areas is simply not as profitable as it should be.
Mr. Gannon?
Yes, thanks. I will address the second question since someone addressed it. On the foreign investments in agriculture, we've seen a big increase in companies and governments going to developing countries and buying land and wanting to invest in agriculture. In principle, it should be a good thing. There is not enough investment in agriculture going around, so if we can attract more investment, it should be a good thing. The problems arise not in the idea of investment, but in the way it's being done. And we are now actually, there's a group of of institutions together with and some countries, and we in FAO, we are coordinating this work, trying to develop some guidelines for the countries themselves as well as for the investors on how to turn those into win-win situations. The problem arises when the foreign investor just comes and buys land, displaces existing people who are already on that land, or wants to produce and export, and there is no real gain for the local population. On the other, but this investment can be done without even any land purchase, working in partnership with the local farmers through outsourcing, through the different types of contracts. And there's a lot of work being happening on that with the objective of really helping people maximize and increase this foreign investment and trying to channel it in directions and ways that would benefit the local farmers, especially the smallholders that many of the panelists have been talking about.
I would like to respond to the question about nutrition and to say that one of the reasons why perhaps we did not tackle that subject enough is that nutrition is so complex. Today we are faced with different levels of nutrition. The rural, hungry, farmer, peasant population is looking at starvation. And the person who is starving does not count how many grams of calcium or magnesium or bio, all those small things that come in small prints that ensure that there's nutrition, which is one aspect of nutrition. The other aspect of nutrition is the fact that the soil upon which food is grown is so degraded that whatever food we buy now is tainted and therefore is not nutritious enough, neither in quantity, in quality, or in variety. And so when you ponder upon all this, it seems as if everybody is suffering from food insecurity. If we even think of the amount of toxins that the fish we eat, it's mind-boggling. So for me, it's a subject that I will approach with great fear, and that's why I suspect we may not have tackled it.
Thank you very much. The wonderful question on belief systems. Actually, I think they're very important.
living in India was for me an overwhelming and overwhelmingly positive experience. And one of the most positive features of it is, alongside a great deal of inertia of people paid to help the poor, were a huge number of people who volunteered to help the poor, to organize rural development, to get self-help groups going. And that was driven entirely by belief systems that were fundamentally generous. These were often people who dropped very successful professional lives in the big city, left everything behind to go and help poorer rural regions in India. On nutrition, I didn't mention it, frankly, because Dr. Gannon had spoken about it at some length, I thought at least. But I would say on nutrition, it's not just a technical question of nutritious foods being available. The point has been made, again by Dr. Gannon, that when people are short of money, they shift their diet and start consuming less nutritious foods. Secondly, when you're dealing with mothers and infants, mothers and children, not all mothers know what they should be doing in terms of nutrition and might do it, in fact, would do it if they knew. So education remains an important part of the picture, including and particularly education of future mothers and mothers.
Thank you very much. The time is passing, so I will let the seven people currently standing put their questions briefly, and then have a last chance to our panelists to offer some thoughts, even though they may not answer every question completely. So we'll start at the front.
Hello. I am director of Embrapa. Embrapa is the Brazilian Corporation for Agriculture Research, and I was feeling not very well. And go from this room, and these young people that can hear feel that we are in a hopeless case. 45 years back in the 60s, Brazil was a receiver for food aid programs. 35 years back in the 70s, we used to buy almost every good. We used to buy maize, beans, milk, and I think that we changed. And we changed it first because we decided to invest in science. Today we have this public institution that is investing this year $800 million in agricultural research. We changed it because we decided to invest in agricultural policies. This year, the credit system of Brazil is lending for the farms around $6 billion. And we estimate that this is one third of the credit system for the agriculture in Brazil. And we changed it because we decided to invest in the poor. Today, we have 12 million families in Brazil receiving around $50 to $100 per month. And for most of the people, it doesn't mean must. But when you go to the developing country, $100 in food is quite a lot of things. And what I'd like to share with you is that in this conference, we have light, we have hope, and we can solve the hunger and the malnutrition in the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I would like to ask to make two comments on the last intervention of Mr. Malone. As far as I know, the stocks decline mainly in China. Didn't decline because of a higher demand in consumption, but because neoliberal doctrine and pressure not to alter the prices. So then it turned out to be a problem in this food crisis. And now other countries are trying to rebuild these stocks because it became really a cushion in these cases. And also, just to contradict Bush wisdom, so sometimes is the data that I have, the Indians, medium average Indian eats 5 kilos of meat per year, while Americans eat 120 kilos. So, I mean, it's okay to accuse Indians and Chinese to become more, but you know, you get what I want to say. Huh? And I wanted to talk about profitability. So we have, on the one hand, this is a question. Sorry, we have, you know, in the one hand, lack of profitability. 80% of farmers in the world cannot are net buyers of food. On the other hand, we have a food crisis, and people are buying more food, more expensive. So, and corporations in between are making huge profits. And so something is, these are factors, the corporation, that nobody's really talking about seriously. You were talking about regulation. I think it's a very good idea. You were talking about gambling, and that's, I think it should be the point. We shouldn't pay more for food. I think we should pay less to corporations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Pons, please. In April of last year, Tim Steiner, head of the UN Environment Program, said, "We have enough food on this planet to feed everyone." He continues, "The way that markets and supplies are currently being influenced by perceptions of future markets is distorting access to food." The question is, wouldn't we find greater food security if we were to disassociate food with the large speculative forces of large financial institutions?
Thank you. At the back, please.
So thank you, thank you for your interventions. My question is about to what extent you think that biofuels are responsible for food prices increasing? So that's my question.
Thank you very much. Please, sir.
80% of the panelists we have today are politicians, and they didn't seem to address the importance of politics in food security. David Malone mentioned it a little bit. It appears to me that most of the problem of food security or insecurity is as a result of politics. Because the politicians in the developing world lack the political will, as has been mentioned. And in international politics, there's a lot of manipulation from trade liberalization and the question of subsidy. It would then appear to me that a matter of politics has to be properly addressed. Because whether you are G8 or G20 or African Union or European Union, these are the people who are taking decisions that affect food production, food insecurity, and so on. And unless we are sincere as politicians and as these panelists are in addressing the obstacles that are being put by politicians, we will have a long way to go.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joe, an alumni of MGL. Maybe two quick question comments. The first is that I think the person working at the Food and Agricultural Organization mentioned that we have a $22 billion gap, I think. Is that for the entire billion people that's malnourished? Because that would be about, I think, $22 per person for a year, which seems like very little money. It would be a great investment, a very, very easy investment. And the second question is, to which extent do you think that, because right now I think there's currently subsidies for several crops, mostly in Europe and in the US, that would be simply not be profitable if they were not subsidized. To which extent do you think that, given that we also want to ensure that our countries have food security as well as Africa, not just Africa, but also the North American countries. To which extent is that? Is it possible to shift that? Basically, to make sure that the subsidies are not going to end up in pump and dump situations. Thank you.
Thank you. And a final question, the front.
Yes, I'm Charbel Dins. I'm a business student
before that I was a science student. My question is more along the lines of biotechnology. I'm interested because it's still a new field, and a lot of politics was talking about the current politics, but I want to know what the panel thinks about the effect of biotechnology as we improve a little bit of the efficiency. A lot of these biotechnologies are more set to corporations and private companies, and want to know what we can do to, or what we're thinking of doing, so that biotechnology advancement would not reduce food security but help increase it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now I leave it to the panelists for final thoughts. Perhaps this time we can start with Mr. Malone and then go down the tables for final thoughts.
Well, thank you very much on these various points. On biofuels, I think it's very difficult to make a sweeping judgment globally. I think Brazil has been tremendously successful, and we shouldn't begrudge Brazil its success in biofuels. It's been good for Brazil and consequently good for many other countries as well. I think there may have been a problem in some countries trying to emulate Brazil's success too quickly, rather than gradually moving towards biofuel production, trying to do it overnight. And that may have upset markets, although I really don't think biofuels were such a big factor in the 2008 food price spike. I know it's been mentioned, but I haven't seen anything convincing suggesting it was a major factor. On meat consumption, listen, I mentioned that it's a very positive development that the middle class is growing all over the world. This is good. What we haven't figured out is how to cope with the consequences of growth of middle classes all over the world. By the way, it's not just in China that stocks dropped. Stocks dropped everywhere. So if you adopt a very ideological approach to your studies and look for the proof that you're trying to demonstrate, you're going to be able to construct it quite easily. So stocks were a problem all over the world in terms of products like rice, notably, and wheat also dropped quite a bit. And what we need to do globally, not just in the South, not just in the North, is to figure out what patterns of food production and consumption are going to work best for everyone and are going to be environmentally sustainable. We haven't even started to do that.
Yes. I would like to start with the question on investing in research. And actually, I think it's a very, very, very important point that has been raised. Because, I mean, I gave you the figures of a declining capital stock in agriculture, but it's also been similar data on declining or stagnating spending on research in agriculture in developing countries. If you look to the future, the 70% increase in food production that is needed, and I said that we feel that it is achievable. It would be achievable through a combination of mainly through increasing yields. We expect in our modeling work, yields increase by 80% in developing countries, and that explains achieving this. Now, how do we bring about this increase in yields? Well, through research, obviously, but also probably as important or more important is the dissemination of the results of this research. We look at data that what we call yield gaps, which is the difference between the actual yields of farms and what can be achieved in an experimental farm. And those yield gaps are huge in most cases, even in developed countries, which indicates that there is a lot that can be achieved in that. One figure that I like to use a lot because it is quite startling is that the average yield for cereals in Africa is about 1 ton per hectare. the average yield for cereals in the developing countries is 3 tons per hectare. So there is a lot that can be gained just by using existing technologies, as well, obviously, as by investing in more research. And if I had time, I would have talked for a long, long time on this issue, which is extremely important. On biofuels and food prices, at FAO last year, we produced we produce every year something that document that we call the State of Food and Agriculture. And last year, the subject of that document was biofuels. And we did a review of all the studies of the impact of the use of biofuels, of the increase in biofuel production on food prices. And those studies are all over the place. They go from 5% increase in the 5% of the increase in prices that we saw can be attributed directly to biofuels to 75%. So there is no consensus in the literature on how much of the increase in prices can be attributed to biofuel production. But it's obvious that by increasing demand through biofuels, that will push prices up. On biofuels, I'd like to. Mr. Dallon made a point which I think is extremely important, but I would like just to repeat something that President Lula said when he was in a speech that he gave in Rome a year and a half ago, a little bit more than a year ago. President Lula said biofuels are like cholesterol. There are good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. There are good biofuels and bad biofuels. It is obvious, for example, the biofuels produced from sugarcane in Brazil, which are sustainable in terms of their economics, they don't require any subsidies, and have a much different impact on food security in the world than biofuels produced from maize, for example, in the United States. So those are this is an important issue that requires more discussion. The very important point, and I know I should stop, on the amount of money. The investment in agriculture is needed to feed everybody. The amount of money that we're talking about is minuscule compared to the money that is paid spent on defense, for example, around the world, or the money that has been spent to save the banks last year. We are really talking about very, very small amounts. And that leads to your point, sir, about the political will. Why isn't there a political will? And since I'm the 20% of this panel that's not a politician, maybe I can speak to that point. Especially in the developing countries, what we observe is that the hungry people have very little voice in the political process. We observe that small farmers have very little voice in the political process. So if the farmers have no voice in the political process, the hungry people have no voice in the political process, it is normal that we find countries unable to mobilize the political will to really tackle those problems, because especially even though the amount of money needed is so small. Hope, you are absolutely right. Actually, here we talked about two countries tonight that have succeeded tremendously in reducing hunger, and they did that by increasing their investment in agriculture. Brazil is always cited as one of the best examples of how to eliminate hunger in a developing country. And actually, Nigeria, if you look at the data for undernourishment in Nigeria, it has declined tremendously. And that started, as the High Commissioner said, in 1999, with a new democratic government, with more investments going to agriculture, and a great deal of hunger reduction in Nigeria.
I agree with the who asked a question about biotechnology. Biotechnology would be the future solution to food insecurity. It would heavily succeed to tackle the issue of population growth. But it's not just biotechnology. All food technologies need to come on board, and to share technology should be the new focus of development aid to Africa and other developing nations. It is not good for us in Africa for you to send money for us to buy food. You are underdeveloping us. Show us the technology to keep our rainwater, to drain our fields, to improve our seeds, and to provide energies that will drive agriculture forward. So I believe that as you share technology with us, you'll be helping us much more than the Zoranis intervention. As for political intervention in food issues, everything is politics. So everything is controlled by politics. So I think that every one of us here is very much aware of us, as you know, that in Nigeria we were able to trace how political development and policy shifts have led to a difference. But one thing, one major thing is that only democracy will guarantee sustainable food security, because the people will have a right to vote for any government that does not guarantee food security for them. It doesn't matter how benevolent the dictator is, if he does not give the people the right of choice, because food security ultimately means acceptability, and which means also that we must all become politically conscious of the conscientization process that is necessary to transit from our present perception about food to the next kind of food that we may be eating. Ultimately, when all the land has been consumed, we may just be taking a pill of nutrient rather than sitting at a dining table to eat. These are also possibilities that might just happen. Thank you.
D'abord, merci à chacune et chacun d'entre vous de votre attention ce soir. Quelques points télégraphiques. Comme mon voisin, je pense que la recherche, la technologie, pas seulement les biotechnologies. Quand on parle de biotechnologie, on ne parle pas seulement des GMO, on parle de l'ensemble des biotechnologies, sont une clé pour demain. Et probablement, lorsque je parlais de projets régionaux agricoles, en Afrique notamment, s'il y a une volonté, un bottom-up, de bâtir de telles politiques régionales, de grandes régions qui se sont déjà organisées, notamment l'Union européenne, ont un devoir de transférer de la technologie pour aider ces politiques régionales agricoles en Afrique à réussir. Les biocarburants, pour moi, la question n'a jamais été la question des biocarburants, mais de la place qu'ils occupent. La place qu'ils occupent de la terre agricole. Est-ce que c'est une place raisonnable, une proportion raisonnable, ou c'est quelque chose qui n'est pas raisonnable, puisque la priorité, c'est l'alimentation. On doit consacrer une priorité des terres à l'alimentation. Nous avons fait un choix politique dans l'Union européenne de ne pas dépasser un certain seuil de la surface agricole utile pour fabriquer des biocarburants. Donc la question n'est pas les biocarburants, on en a besoin, notamment quand on n'a pas de pétrole ou de gaz, mais c'est la proportion qui doit rester modeste dans l'usage des terres agricoles. Profitabilité. On est sur une question fondamentale du modèle agricole que l'on veut. Si vous voulez préserver un modèle alimentaire et un modèle de petites et moyennes exploitations qui font vivre les territoires, vous n'avez pas de profitabilité s'il n'y a pas de politique publique. Nous avons besoin de politique publique. Sinon, vous allez vers un autre modèle, qui est celui de l'industrie agricole, où seuls les plus gros, les plus concentrés, les plus industrialisés, les usines à lait, peuvent réussir. Donc nous avons besoin de politique publique et de politique de régulation. Je reviens à la question des stocks. Depuis l'Antiquité, en Égypte, en Chine, on sait que les stocks de matières alimentaires sont le moyen de se préserver de l'instabilité des marchés. Et aujourd'hui, c'est la politique de dérégulation générale dans le monde qui a contribué à supprimer les stocks. Moi, je pense que nous avons besoin de régulation, de politique moderne de stockage au niveau de certaines régions, pour notamment lutter contre les phénomènes de la spéculation ou de l'hyperspéculation, qui est la plus scandaleuse sur les matières premières. Donc on voit bien que tout ça revient à des politiques publiques. Hein. Et j'ai essayé dans mon propos tout à l'heure de dire ma confiance dans cette nouvelle gouvernance mondiale en matière alimentaire qui ne se réduit pas à l'Organisation mondiale du commerce, qui doit être plus que ça, et également ma confiance dans la capacité des dirigeants politiques, notamment d'Afrique, de bâtir ensemble, et nous devons les aider, des modèles régionaux de développement agricole. Merci de votre attention.
I think I'll cover two topics that amongst the questions that were asked. The first is the issue of cost to consumers, the issue of profit in the agricultural sector, and the second topic was the role of politicians in all of this. On the first one, I think we have to be clear about differentiating the cost of food on the one hand, the price consumers pay on the one hand, and on the other hand, the revenues that farmers and primary producers receive. Because it's easy to conflate the two, because the two often are not at all related. In Canada, for example, households in Canada spend about $100 billion purchasing food every year. That's largely unrelated to the $40 billion that farmers receive for producing food, because we are in a lot of markets in Canada, we're globalized. So a corn producer in Wellington County, Ontario, is more likely to be selling his feed corn, to an American processor down in Ohio than he is to a local flour mill. And the local flour mill located in Mississauga, I think, for example, there's a big flour mill in Mississauga, is more likely to be purchasing wheat from the American Midwest than it is from the Canadian prairies. So there's a big disconnect between the price people pay at the supermarket and the revenues farmers receive. And I think it's important to remember that when we're having this debate, so we have greater clarity. I think also there's a big disconnect between farmers on the one hand and secondary processors. In Canada, as I mentioned before, there are 230,000 farms. There aren't 230,000 processors. You know, we have at the secondary level, dozens of processors, and at the tertiary level, the supermarket level, we actually have maybe a handful of supermarkets. There's only about half a dozen supermarket owners. So I think there's an issue of competition there, but the Competition Bureau in Canada has assured us on a number of occasions in the last decade or two that they've investigated this. They don't think there's any sort of anti-competitive behaviors going on, but it just seems to be a disconnect. And finally, on the issue of profit, I'll say that one of the things that my colleagues here up on the stage have asked, Ganam has reiterated time and time again, is that we need greater investments in agriculture in order to spur productivity growth, in order to spur, to meet the challenge of feeding the world's poor. And I think there's two types of investments in agriculture. There's public investments that governments make through granting institutions to universities, through direct investments in agriculture for research and development and the like. And on the other hand, there's private sector investment. And one of the statistics that he mentioned that popped out at me was that for the 15-year period ending in 1990, global capital stocks grew by 1.1%, but in the period from 1991 to 2007, they only grew by half that amount. Well, to me, on the private sector side, the real reason for that is clear. It's not profitable sector, and I'm not going to put my capital in it
I'm going to put my capital elsewhere. So I think the issue of profitability is one that needs to be addressed. Finally, on the issue of politicians, you know, I can tell you that it's a difficult job to balance various competing interests. And the big hope over the last number of years was that Doha was going to successfully conclude with a liberalized trading regime for agriculture. That increasingly is looking unlikely. And you just have to look to domestic political pressures in all these countries to see that there's huge pressures in not to liberalize trade. I'll give you an example in Canada. We have 20,000 farms in Canada out of the 230,000 farms that are protected. They're called supply managed farms. It's only 10% of our farms. These 10% of our farms produce close to 50% of all farm profit. Part of trade liberalization would involve rolling back the protection of these farms. And these farms produce four products in Canadian supermarkets: eggs, chickens, milk, and turkeys. If you go to a Canadian supermarket, you buy those four products, they will be domestically produced because it is a completely closed market. So trade liberalization would involve lifting the super trade tariffs we have on those four products for imports. And the super trade tariffs are 250%. If we were to lift those, here are the implications. We'd have to purchase billions of dollars in quota from these farmers back. We'd have to raise taxes. Why? Because we need to supplement income support programs, because these farmers will now go on income support. They would be upset as a political base because their profitability would go down. And finally, we have to deal with the issue of different standards. For example, in the United States, they use growth hormone in their cattle. We don't allow it here because we think it's a threat to human health. So how do you deal with those trade, those distorting safety standards? So these are some of the issues that we as politicians face. So when people say you should just liberalize trade and reduce these barriers, there are huge political pressures on the other hand, and revenue pressures that we also have to address. So it's not as simple as the political will to do it. There's also pushback on the other side in order not to do it.
Well, it's just left me to thank you for your patience, which I think was richly rewarded by the insightful and thought-provoking contributions of our panelists. So just join me in thanking them for their contributions.